Welcome to Politics and Psychology. Today we are discussing Judge the Judges, and we are specifically referring to the Supreme Court of the United States federal judges. With the 2024 federal elections for president, it's also time for America to start considering the judgment and the voting for or voting out of Supreme Court justices. And we'll discuss why term limits are being used against our society and for the benefit of the judges, and is taking them away for the original purpose that was intended as written in the Constitution. So thank you for joining, and let's get started. The United States Constitution was written in 1787, and the purpose of this Constitution was to create a government with enough power to act on a national level, but without too much power where the government would then take away the basic rights of citizens. The basic rights meaning the right to vote, the freedom of speech, freedom to bear arms, etc. And the motivation behind specifying a limitation of the government's national powers was because the writers of the Constitution did not want to repeat what they had in England, where they were being controlled by a monarchy. So one way to avoid the risk of the government having too much power was by separating the power into three individual branches, and that would include a way for them to have a distribution of power, as well as an opportunity for checks and balances. And those three branches are the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. And the judicial branch is where the Supreme Court comes into play. Under Article 3 of the Constitution, not only is the judicial branch established, but it also establishes that the Congress, which is the senators and the House of Representatives, that it gives them the freedom to structure the federal judiciary. So federal judiciary, meaning federal, the government for the nation of the United States, and judiciary, meaning a system or a structure of courts of law. So when we have the federal judiciary, it means the federal or the national court system. And this is also broken into three levels. So we have the federal district courts, the federal circuit courts, and then the Supreme Court. So these are all on the federal, meaning on a national level. Now you do have state courts that are district courts and circuit courts, but those are the state courts. State courts different from the federal courts in that the federal courts that you will still have in every state, the federal courts only address laws that are related to the Constitution or laws that have been put in place on a federal or a national level, whereas the states do not have that restriction. And federal judges and the Supreme Court judges, again, are federally appointed by the president and then confirmed with the advice or the consent of the United States Senate. The Constitution specifies that they will have no term limit, meaning that they have a lifetime appointment and shall, quote, hold their offices during good behavior, end quote. So basically this means that they will have a lifetime appointment unless removed by either retirement or death. And the other option would be if they would be forced to be removed, and the only way to do that is through impeachment. Now it mentioned shall hold offices during, quote, good behavior. So then what is good behavior? Because we have seen in recent years, specifically in the last 20 years, that there has been an absence of good behavior, a widespread media publication of bad behavior, yet these judges are still in place. And this is what we need to focus on when considering, should we no longer limit their presence in office to be lifetime or without a limit. So according to the Constitution, again, Article 2, Section 4, it specifies what impeachment means. It specifies that the President of the United States, the Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed for impeachment on or conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. And this is where the problem comes in, because many of these officers of the court, even the president or the vice president, often have a legal background or a history of political knowledge and political science. And so then they were able to use this information, as they would do in a regular court, to use language to then get themselves out of sticky situations where the public may not be aware on what the actual definition of good behavior or grounds for impeachment are. And this is because we are not in those fields, and so they would know how to use that information against or for their protection and against, you know, for their defense. This is the same thing when you have wealthy individuals who know how to get around tax codes because they have higher knowledge of tax loopholes that the general public may not have the same access to. And it's because of this knowledge that past presidents of the United States, past members of Congress, and even members of the federal judges have also said that, well, I'm not committing a crime, therefore there's no grounds to impeach me. But again, they are misinterpreting deliberately what the Constitution allows and what the framers of the Constitution intended. So how do we know what the writers or the framers of the Constitution actually meant? Well, we can know this by looking at, well, what were their actions or what were their specific words regarding impeachment? And what have they done historically when it comes to impeaching a Supreme Court judge or the President of the United States? So let's look at our first example. Alexander Hamilton. So he was one of, obviously, the original writers of the Constitution. And when we had the first act of impeachment in the United States, then what Alexander Hamilton wrote is that impeachment is not only for criminal acts, and that non-criminal acts can be impeachable if the act or behavior results in the abuse or violation of some public trust. Then, in 1833, Justice Joseph Story argued that to impeach a federal leader, there does not need to be a requirement of any previous laws to base the impeachment as official misconduct. This is important to know because if you watch Law and Order or any other crime show, lawyers will often use precedent of previous laws or previous findings to then justify what their arguments are, either to go someone to be, you know, criminalized or penalized or to be let go free. And so what the framers are saying is that we don't have to have a precedent of any prior president or any prior justice having committed an act and then using that as the grounds for this present act for impeachment. If the behavior of that federal appointee or federal position is done in any way that will violate or appear to violate or abuse public trust, that would be a definition for misconduct and therefore qualify that individual for impeachment. Let's look at additional examples. So in the first impeachment was in 1797 by Senator William Blount, and he was impeached for creating a scheme to give Great Britain control over Florida and Louisiana territories. So the Senate expelled him because they concluded that the senator committed a high misdemeanor, extremely inconsistent with public trust and duty. The House impeached him in five articles because of betrayals of trust and national interest. So again, this is the abuse or the appearance to abuse public trust, and this is not anything where it's criminal. So present day, many of the judges are saying, well, it's not criminal, and that's what the Constitution says, so therefore I shouldn't be penalized or impeached or kicked out of this office. But if they were looking at the actual language of what their predecessors of the Constitution actually wrote, or predecessors even for these Supreme Court justices have said, they would then acknowledge that, well, it wasn't a crime, but it does destroy or abuse public trust. We have two other examples. In 1803 and 1873, two judges were impeached not for a crime, but for drunkenness. But clearly, being drunk, although it's not healthy, it's not a criminal act, but judges have been in the past, have been impeached because of acts that were non-criminal, including drunkenness. So of these two judges that I mentioned for the drunkenness, Judge John Pickering was convicted and removed from office because of the drunken behavior. And Judge Mark DeLahey, he was retired, or he voluntarily retired before he had a chance to be convicted and then removed. So again, this is the same thing where you're like, oh, well, you didn't fire me, I quit. So we obviously know what's going to happen. So he tried to avoid the public smear. In 1868, President Andrew Johnson was also impeached, and he was impeached for abusing presidential authority. Again, not a crime, but a misuse of power, and also the appearance to abuse the public trust. In 1926, Judge George English was impeached for abusive and biased behavior. However, he also resigned before his trial, and so was Judge Harold Lauterbach in 1933, impeached for abusive and biased behavior. If you look throughout history, especially during the early years, during the recent aftermath of the formation of the Constitution, there are multiple other examples of impeachments for behaviors that appear to violate or abuse public trust, but were not indeed crimes themselves. This goes from falsifying expense receipts in December of 1904 to another administrator being impeached for improper administration of government contracts, 1876, which definitely happens now, and in 1912, the improper appointment of a juror. Those are earlier examples. Now let's look at more recent examples. In 1984, Judge Harry Claiborne was impeached and convicted for tax fraud in the District of Nevada. And in 2010, Judge G. Thomas Porteous Jr., through a unanimous vote, was impeached on four articles. And these were for knowingly making false statements about his past to both the Senate and the FBI during his interviews for obtaining federal judgeship, and also knowingly making false statements under penalty and perjury for other issues. We currently have nine justices. One is a chief justice who is responsible for administration of the court, and then we have eight associate justices. Our current chief justice is John G. Roberts. And our current eight associate justices are Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Comey Barrett, and Ketanji Brown Jackson. And of these nine, five of the Supreme Court justices were present and sitting in office during the 2010 impeachment of a federal judge, not for a crime, but for misbehavior. And these were Chief Justice Roberts and Associate Judges Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. Remember, the Constitution does not give any specific requirements or qualifications needed to become a U.S. Supreme Court judge. However, they usually do have a law background, and this time all nine of the justices do have a law background, meaning an attorney background, licensure as a lawyer or an attorney. Sometimes, though, you may also have individuals who are just professors of law. But again, these all nine justices do have legal backgrounds and have been licensed as attorneys. So they are thus very familiar with the law. They are also, as we mentioned, five of them familiar with past impeachment of a federal judge because of acts that were not necessarily illegal, but did erode or appear to abuse public trust. So with that knowledge, if they were truly compared or concerned about the impact of the perception, the public's perception of the Supreme Court and of the justices, then we would assume and hope that they would act and honor based off of that trust. But that is not happening. And let's look at the specific actions of these nine justices. Justice Samuel Alito has accepted private jet flights and luxury vacations, with the most recent incident being a luxury Alaska vacation from a hedge fund billionaire, Paul Singer. For the past 20 years that Justice Clarence Thomas has been in office, he has also accepted luxury trips. Also, he has accepted other gifts that are of question. For example, a billionaire bought his mother's house, paid tens of thousands of dollars and put into it for renovations, and then let her live there without having to pay him any rent. This same billionaire, a Texas billionaire, also paid for Thomas's grandnephew's private school education and did not ask for any of this to be repaid. So although Clarence Thomas is the most notable face for misconduct or the appearance to abuse public trust, he still is in office despite multiple incidents of him engaging in acts that are questionable. For example, although his ethics have been called into question, he has yet to recuse himself, or he has yet to acknowledge or even go back and acknowledge in his required financial disclosures where many of his gifts have come from, yet we'll see social media posts or other pictures or even paintings of him being in luxury resorts, being in vacations that have been paid for by millionaires, multimillionaires, or even billionaires. He also has questionable actions and presence when it comes to family relationships. For example, because of the 2022 attempt to overturn the presidential election, his wife, Virginia, known as Jenny, was involved in those acts, with text messages and emails from Virginia or Jenny showing where she attempted to not only encourage others to also help former President overturn the 2020 election results, but that she was involved in putting pressure on other elected officials to also support these claims. So if this is for a presidential election at the federal level, and the Supreme Court is also involved in overhearing federal level or constitution level cases, then it is a clear conflict of interest for your wife to be a subject of these complaints and for you as the Supreme Court, one of the highest judges in the land, to then be involved in overseeing that. So obviously you are going to be biased. Similar to Justice Thomas using his position as a supreme law of the land to obtain financial favors from wealthy individuals, Justice Neil Gorsuch has also been the recipient. For example, in 2017, he has a 40-acre property that he owned or co-owned in Colorado. And for years, he was trying to sell this property and no one was buying it. Yet, 9 days after he was confirmed to the Supreme Court, the property was purchased by a wealthy CEO of a law firm who had numerous cases to come before the Supreme Court. And not only did Justice Gorsuch not report that this was a recent transaction that occurred 9 days after, or the appearance of it being questionable, considering he only was able to make the sale 9 days after being appointed, yet had no success in making the sale for years before his appointment, he also failed to disclose who the owner or the buyer of his property was. And he only put that it was between a range of $250,000 to $500,000 that he made off of the sale. So there are two boxes on these financial disclosure forms. You write, well, there's more than those boxes, but these are two that we're thinking about. So on the two boxes that are next to each other, it's, well, how much did you receive and where or from whom did you receive this gift or financial consideration? So he checked off the box for how much he received, which was the $250,000 to $500,000 off the sale, but he deliberately left the box blank for disclosing who was the person or the entity who paid this money. So again, very deliberate. We also have Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who has used her influence and position as a justice for her private book sales and using her taxpayer-funded staff to help promote her book sales and to push her book sales off on the general public. For example, we have found multiple emails and other documents showing where Sotomayor's assistant was pressing educational academic institutions that she was invited to speak at, which is allowed, but she was in the office, Sotomayor's office was encouraging staff and pressuring the staff at these colleges to purchase additional copies of the justice's books. One email shows the assistant told a library official that their purchase of $250 was, quote, definitely not enough, and encouraged them to buy more books. So you're using a position where you are allowed to give speaking engagements. You are allowed to receive honoraria for being a speaker at colleges and universities. and things that don't appear to have any direct conflict of interest. But if you're also writing books and you can make an unlimited amount of income from writing books and selling your books, being an author, so if you are using your position as a justice to then promote your book sales, that is a direct conflict of interest. Let's look at some of the previous judges. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 2018 took a trip to Israel, compliments of a billionaire named Morris Kahn, K-A-H-N. And this billionaire is a business owner who has several companies that often have cases that have to come before the United States Supreme Court, of which at that time, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a part of. In the 2017 case, the Supreme Court members at that time, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg, had to oversee a case where another company was accusing Kahn's company, which is called Amdocs, A-M-D-O-C-S Limited. It was accusing them of having questionable patent eligibility claims. And so the company was saying that this company that Kahn had did not have any eligibility to use this patent. And of course, what do you think happened? The case was denied and not even able to be brought fully to being presented before the court. So then you have a few months later, 2018, now Ginsburg is being, you know, given this complimentary trip. And she was also, in other instances, given food, transportation, and lodging as a tourist and a guest of this Israeli businessman. Also in 2018, all nine of the Supreme Court justices took trips. They actually took a combined total of 64 trips throughout the world in which their transportation, food, and lodging were reimbursed by others. Now, this is allowed if it's related to their role and their expenses are reimbursed and also documented. However, what happened was it wasn't that the Supreme Court justices were reimbursing them, but that other individuals or other companies were paying these reimbursements for the Supreme Court justices. Also in 2018, although all nine justices took 64 trips, it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg who took the most and took 14 trips. Another late justice, Justice Antonin Scalia, he took at least 258 subsidized trips while he was on court. And it was actually when he was on one of these trips when he suddenly died in 2016. We have retired Justice Stephen Breyer took at least 225 subsidized trips between 2004 and 2016. And this includes a 2013 trip to the exclusive island of Nantucket, also compliments of a private equity billionaire by the name of David Rubenstein. And when we look at just the recent vacationing behaviors between 2004 and 2019, at least 1,309 trips have been recorded where Supreme Court justices took vacations or trips that were paid for by others. Now, again, the justices are allowed to speak and get paid for these speaking engagements, also allowed to author books, and even allowed to have transportation that's paid for by the person and not a company. But what they are doing is having a person who also owns, through their company, private land, private estates, private yachts, and then they are then being the direct recipients of that third-party connection. So they are still benefiting, and it is still a conflict of interest. Also, what some of the institutions are doing academically to entice the justices to come and speak at their events is to not just pay them for their speaking engagement, which would be considered authorized constitutional activity, but then they're giving them these luscious or luxurious vacations attached to the package of them being a speaker. So what you would have is a one school then paying for a justice to come speak, but then also giving them, for example, like luxury tickets to a resort. So all the justices, however, must abide by the $30,000 earnings limit for teaching. And to get around this $30,000 limit, then several law schools have used their positions as an all-expense-paid getaway where the justices could take advantage of these perks while, quote-unquote, teaching, even if that teaching is $30,000 paid to them for just one day or one week, and it just happens to be located on a luxury resort or near a luxury resort with luxury amenities. For example, the Scalia School of Law at the George Mason University in Virginia flew Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh to Italy, Iceland, and England, despite the actual campus for the school just being right across the Potomac River of the Supreme Court. The school also paid the justices living expenses for their two-week summer courses abroad. We know about these trips and the other activities and trips that I mentioned because the justices are required to submit annual financial disclosures in which they have to outline, again, who gave them what, when, and for how much. Now, they do have a limit, again, for $30,000 for a teaching. They also have a limit on how much gifts can be. They are not allowed to receive any gift worth more than $415 or anything of value that is not fully reimbursed by them. The way that they're getting around it is indeed having gifts that are over $415 but are being reimbursed by other entities, or they're using it under the guise of, well, this is for education, and these living expenses, which are allowed, food and lodging under the hospitality clause are allowed if it's the individual, but that individual, again, just happens to be either a wealthy person who does also own the property and therefore is able to give them above average or above normal amenities and living standards that would not be if you had just gone and purchased these hotel rooms or the island for a day. Another way that the justices are getting around it is just by omitting altogether disclosures of what they have received, especially if it has gone into the excess or over the amount of $415. Justice Clarence Thomas has done this repeatedly, and despite him doing this repeatedly and it being acknowledged and publicly known, he has not gone back to change or adjust his financial disclosures to be more accurate and transparent. Neither has Justice Gorsuch removed or made any amendments to his prior financial disclosures that did not include many of the gifts that he has received, either for gifts or real estate transactions. So when we look at the direct and the indirect acts of Supreme Court justices that lead to the appearance of and the actual occurrence of public mistrust and the abuse of mistrust, as the framers of the Constitution wrote, that's why we are seeing a widespread increase of mistrust and complaints about the Supreme Court justices having no oversight because they're the highest court in the land and having no one to hold them accountable. So we have direct instances by seeing what they're directly receiving as a conflict of interest. For example, receiving a trip in 1 year after having ruled favorably for that defendant in a Supreme Court case, or indirectly by deliberately omitting that you have received financial gifts or monetary and highly valuable favors and gifts from an entity that can or appears to be able to have a likely influence on your present or future rulings in cases that involve that industry, that person's business, or that person's line of work. So these are clear conflict of interest, and that's what's causing a widespread call for the justices to then be judged for their behaviors and to have higher accounts of accountability. So what has been done to try to increase transparency or holding the Supreme Court justices accountable for their actions? Well, the same Chief Justice that we have now, Justice Roberts, has been there for over a decade. And when we had, similarly, over 10 years ago, the same push for them to be transparent, then the Chief Justice, speaking on behalf of the other justices, refused to consider the addition of oversight and also added that it only would negatively hurt the public by creating an image that they cannot be trusted, and that what was actually happening was a misunderstanding of the true roles and the true rules that apply to the Supreme Court justices are different from what applies to other federal judges that are located within their state. Nonetheless, because there was still consistent pushback, he said, okay, look, Well, what we'll do is we will conduct a study to see, well, then what laws can we create for the Supreme Court justices that can be applied to help with ethics? That was over 10 years ago, and of course, that study was never completed or the results never shown to the public. But what they did do 10 years later in 2016, those same judges unanimously voted to make it a lot harder to prosecute public officials, including Supreme Court justices, for accepting bribes. So if you're making it harder to prosecute someone for bribery, and bribery is one of the three clauses of behaviors mentioned in the Constitution on how to impeach a Supreme Court justice or any other federal officer, including the President of the United States, then by making it harder to prosecute themselves, they are in fact trying to further insulate themselves from being impeached. So what we do see is a trend where the justices of recent are not inputting laws that will help create transparency or protect the public's trust as the Constitution would require, but instead they're engaging in behaviors that would then cover up or protect themselves from their own misdeeds. Because they were focusing on protecting themselves rather than being transparent or engaging in true change, their behaviors continued, and the public again had enough of it and put out a call to Congress for them to act. So in February of 2023, the Senate introduced S-359, which is the Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act of 2023, to try to put more transparency and legislative oversight for the Supreme Court justices. We also have a bill introduced, which is H.R. 3973, for the Judicial Ethics and Anti-Corruption Act of 2023, with both of these acts from the House and from the Senate being introduced as a way to provide a more transparent understanding of what judges are doing or justices are doing in the Supreme Court, as well as to provide objective third-party oversight of what's happening. So, because Congress, which is the House of Representatives and the Senate, are involved through the Constitution of the structure and the funding of the Supreme Court, and they are able to introduce legislation to help that Supreme Court work on behalf of the people rather than the justices, the Supreme Court justices were able to read the room and the writing on the wall, and just like with their Supreme Court justice predecessors, decided to act preemptively to not have any legislation enacted against them that would go against their being able to stay in Supreme Court or without any type of oversight. So in November of 2023, all nine justices released a joint statement that reaffirmed their voluntary adherence to a general code of conduct. But what they did was they refused any proposals for any independent oversight, any mandatory compliance with ethics rules, and they also refuse to have any greater transparency in cases of recusal. So what you have here is someone saying, okay, look, we know we've been kind of shady and we'll agree to just continue to be more honest. So they're using language that implies they were doing something that they were not doing. They were not being honest. They were not being transparent. They were not avoiding any misperceptions of misbehavior, which is why these bills were being introduced. But by them saying we will continue to adhere to a general code of conduct, that's saying something that they were really not doing. They are also refusing to have any general oversight or any independent oversight of what they're doing. So this letting us know that, well, we're agreeing to just continue doing what we're doing. We're going to put out a statement so that you don't put any legislation in against the powers that we have, against the independence that we have, and therefore we're going to do a preemptive strike to say, okay, we give, we'll be better, but we don't want you to introduce anybody else into what we're doing. So that really is not giving any true votes of confidence for the general public, because then Senate and the House didn't proceed any further, so it allowed the justices to be able to have more time to just continue to do what they have been doing. And this is where we, as voters, as citizens of this country, can have a stronger voice in what's happening in our country. The Supreme Court of the United States has supreme authority over the laws not only of the nation, but also can dictate laws for the nation that will impact your direct zip code, your direct family. They also have the last word whenever it comes to law. So if you have an appeal, the highest place that you can go for an answer or for help is the Supreme Court. But if the highest law of the land is from justices that are judging from a place that has questionable ethics, you cannot be certain or you cannot have confidence that the Supreme Court will indeed act on what's best for you, for your community, or for this country if their ethics as justices is questionable and if they are putting in laws to help protect their questionable nature. Looking back at the Constitution, it was deliberately put in for the Supreme Court justices to have a lifetime appointment so that they would not be tempted to have to worry about being reelected, having to get funding for their campaigns, and to make them less vulnerable to bribery and to make them less vulnerable to be beholden to special interest groups. So the goal was to protect the justices to be able to act fairly and with transparency for what was best for that case according to law and what was best to our country according to law without it having a personal interest in saving their role or saving their career and their income as the justice. That's also why the Constitution provides that the justices are not allowed to have any decreases in their salary. Therefore, what they came in as will be at least the minimum that they get for their tenure as the Supreme Court justice, rather than having fears of, well, if I don't do this, I'm not going to get a raise, or if I do vote according to one particular way that someone in Congress does not like, then they're going to vote to demote me or decrease my salary. So all of these protections were put in place to not only help protect the justices to remain external and objective, but it was also to protect us as voters. What we are seeing is a turning and a twisting of what the original framers of the Constitution intended for us to be able to have protections of a unbiased set of justices, to now those same justices in positions where they are not being the subject of power, but that they are being the rulers of their power, and they are using their power as the supreme law of the land to then gain favors, not for our country, not for your community, but for themselves, for their grandnephews to have private tuition, for private yacht trips, for luxury vacations, for additional revenue, for their income. Nothing to do at all with our country. So what we can do is hold Congress accountable and not falling wimpy to the claims of the Supreme Court justices, of our current Supreme Court justices, to say, okay, well, we'll just issue our own code of ethics, but we don't want any oversight. What we can do instead is contact your senators, contact your representatives, and let them know that we do want them to act on these bills, which is H.R. 3973, Judicial Ethics and Anti-Corruption Act of 2023, and also S.359, which is the Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act of 2023. Also, push your congressperson to also push for the external oversight of the Supreme Court justices and their ethics and the transparency of the transactions and gifts that they receive from either individuals in the states or definitely from foreign parties. I also encourage and ask you to communicate what we learned today as far as the grounds for impeachment according to the Constitution for our Supreme Court justices, and to educate those in your circle to understand that impeachment is not only for an act of crime or a misdemeanor, but according to the Constitution, for any acts that would violate, abuse, or appear to abuse the perception of public trust. If we apply the direct definitions of impeachment according to the Constitution and transpose that to the actual acts of our justices today, we will see that the majority, if not all of them, are an extreme violation of not only ethics, but also the perception and abuse of public trust. So I thank you for listening. I thank you for spreading and informing others in your network so that we can all be on the same page and act knowledgeably. And to make it easier for you, I have included links to the legislation inside the description of this episode. And if you go to the Instagram page for the Politics and Psychology, then you will also have the direct links to how to contact your individual House of Representative member or your senator, and then letting them know to support and push forward on the bills to ensure transparency and trust of our Supreme Court justices. So I thank you for listening. And as always, I thank you for continuing this conversation and doing so with science and love. Walk the path of life. And if you